Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, quaint as it may sound, the idea is still operative for many people that if you work, you earn wages and fair treatment. We can't seem to shake the storyline that employers graciously offer this and workers should gratefully accept it. But a new report outlines just how tilted the workplace balance of power has become in this country and what we need to do to restore workers' voice and power at work. Titled Unchecked Corporate Power, Forced Arbitration, The Enforcement Crisis, and How Workers Are Fighting Back, the report comes from the Center for Popular Democracy and the Economic Policy Institute. We'll speak with one of the authors, EPI's Director of Government Affairs and Labor Council, Celine McNicholas. Also on the show, government actors have, it seems, endless reasons to shroud their actions in secrecy. That's why tools like the Freedom of Information Act and state open records laws are so critical. It turns out it isn't journalists who are making the most of FOIA, for instance, but other people and increasingly activists working with, but if necessary, around gatekeeper media to achieve social justice goals. The Center for Constitutional Rights has a new project aimed at helping those efforts along. We'll talk with project coordinator Ian Head. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. As many as 1 million of the estimated 8 million plant and animal species on Earth are at risk of extinction, many of them within decades, according to the scientists and researchers behind a new UN report. The assessment by the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services is the most comprehensive review to date of the damage humans are causing to biodiversity. The group's chair, Robert Watson, says, quote, "The health of ecosystems on which we and all other species depend is deteriorating more rapidly than ever. We are eroding the very foundations of our economies, livelihoods, food security, health, and quality of life worldwide." Close quote. Nevertheless, a survey by German newspaper Deutsche Welle found that the report and its grave implications didn't get the front page stories you might expect for news of this import. And they suggest, sadly, that that has to do with the fact that the assessment was released on the same day that the Duke and Duchess of Sussex had their first child. Their findings matched those of U.S. group Media Matters, which noted that ABC News, for one, gave more time to the royal baby's birth in the week after he was born than to all stories about the climate crisis in all of 2018. The UN report calls on policymakers to take immediate, concrete action to protect nature, sustainable agricultural practices, equitable water management, renewable energy resources, and more. It's beyond shameful that among the obstacles such crucial efforts face, corporate media disinterest looms large. And listeners may not have heard, but Congress approved construction of a monument on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., honoring military active in Operation Desert Storm and Operation Desert Shield, in other words, the Gulf War. Activist David Swanson, author of War is a Lie and executive director of worldbeyondwar.org, had questions about that. 10 questions, in fact. A sample. There's no monument to the arming of Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War, without which there could have been no Gulf War, and no monument yet to the deadly sanctions and bombings that followed, or to the 2003 begun war on Iraq, which couldn't have happened without the Gulf War. Why pick out the Gulf War segment of the endless war on Iraq to memorialize? Will the monument include any depictions of fictional infants taken out of imaginary incubators? How will the overwhelmingly Iraqi victims of the Gulf War be memorialized? The United States killed 30,000 retreating Iraqi soldiers. Will they perhaps be depicted mooning the U.S. Institute of Peace across the street? Will victims of Gulf War syndrome be remembered with an eternal open burn pit? And prior to the Gulf War, Iraq proposed to withdraw from Kuwait if Israel withdrew from the Palestinian territories. Iraq proposed a WMD-free Middle East, including itself and every other Middle Eastern nation. Many nations around the world encouraged pursuing those negotiations with Iraq. The United States preferred war. Was that a wise choice? What do we have to show for it beyond death, destruction, bitter animosity, illness, homeless veterans, environmental devastation, bigotry and racism run amok, eroded civil liberties, militarized police, a violent culture, and one more disgusting monument to mass murder with which to edify our children? You can find David Swanson's full list of questions at his blog, warisacrime.org. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Fast food workers winning a higher minimum wage, public school teachers winning smaller class sizes. Workers have had some remarkable victories recently. At the same time, a new report from the Economic Policy Institute and the Center for Popular Democracy describes the disturbing rise of a particular constraint on workers' voices and their power. The press release for the report contains a quote that presents the problem clearly. Brenda Rojas, a college student in Oregon, says, quote, "While working at Buffalo Wild Wings, my coworkers and I experienced wage theft regularly and worked in an environment of constant sexual harassment. Complaining about these working conditions was pointless because we had signed a forced arbitration clause and the company knew that we couldn't fight back in court. None of us understood the forced arbitration language when we signed our new hire paperwork, but we were told that if we did not check all the boxes, we would not be hired. How can students like me build a brighter economic future when our employers are allowed to rip us off?" Close quote. How indeed. But there is resistance, too, to be found in the report called Unchecked Corporate Power: Forced Arbitration, the Enforcement Crisis, and How Workers Are Fighting Back. We're joined now by one of the report's authors. Celine McNicholas is Director of Government Affairs and Labor Council at the Economic Policy Institute. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Celine McNicholas.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, the report was released for a reason on the one-year anniversary of a Supreme Court decision. What was the significance of Epic Systems versus Lewis? How did that ruling spur this report?
Epic Systems essentially codified the problem that you just revealed in the quote that you read, that workers are increasingly being required to sign away their right to sue when their employment rights are violated by their employer. And Epic Systems essentially greenlighted employers embracing that practice. And unfortunately, going into the decision, you know, the majority of workers were already sort of facing the threat of this. And we now know that employers are increasingly embracing it since the decision. So a year out, we're seeing this more and more.
Well, we talk in media and elsewhere about the labor market as though people were mobile economic actors who can make informed choices about where to work. So if you don't want to sign away your right to a class action lawsuit, the unspoken thinking goes, don't take a job that requires it. Well, we should take issue with that idea. And obviously, people have never been identically situated with regard to choices. But your report makes it clear that in the private sector, in the non-union private sector, not signing these things is increasingly just not an option. And it's not just college students and their first jobs.
That's exactly right. You know, and I think you hit on the fundamental myth, right, that we're all sort of free agents in this economy. And I think it's wonderfully encouraging that unemployment continues to decrease and, you know, wages for the first time in a long time are actually experiencing some level of an uptick. But still, you know, most working people feel lucky to have a job and feel that they have very little leverage in that initial negotiation with their employer for the terms and conditions of their work. And so in practicality, we all know well. We can all sort of admit that we signed the paperwork on the first day on the job, and, you know, we're happy to be signing up for, potentially if we're lucky enough to sign up for health care and all of the other tangential forms, you know, we also may be signing away this right without even really realizing the implications of what we've been asked to sign as a condition of working there. And that's a really troubling trend because it applies across all employment rights.
Well, these forced arbitration clauses that the report says projects by 2024, 80% of private sector non-union workers will be covered by these forced arbitration clauses. Let's spell it out. What is wrong with forced arbitration?
So short answer is everything. We'll go into detail here. So essentially, when you are forced to arbitrate a claim, an employment claim, I would argue in particular, because we just talked about the fact that most workers, you have limited leverage on the job. The employer, if they're not happy with you, you know, they can fire you for any reason at all, just not a narrow set of prohibited reasons that are, you know, protected reasons under the law. Right. Let's say you're being sexually harassed in your workplace, but you've been forced to sign an arbitration agreement on that first day. That means that if you're not getting any kind of relief, you go to HR, you go to your supervisor, and he or she says, okay, we're going to help you resolve this, but we're going to do it through arbitration. You have no right to sue us. That immediately limits your leverage, but it also puts you into a process that hugely favors that employer because you're going it alone, you're using a system that they're paying for, they being the employer, that disadvantages all workers.
You very specifically are prohibited from joining together with other folks in the workplace who are experiencing the same problems that you might be.
Yes, because many of these waivers include what you just referenced, a class or collective action component. And that means that you're in this system, arbitration, which is this unequal, unfair system, because the employer is really the entity that is a repeat player. That means that they are more familiar with the arbitrators. They're often giving them business. So there's sort of this implied injustice in the whole system itself. But then in addition to that, you're doing this alone. You're navigating it as an individual worker. Whereas if you brought suit as a class or collective action, you would have a great deal more leverage.
And I understand that mainly what it does is just kind of discourage. It's not even so much that workers lose when they go through this process. Knowing that that's their only option pretty much discourages them from taking action in the first place.
I think that that's exactly right, and it makes a lot of sense if you think about it. Just think of how difficult in practicality it is to voice any kind of concern in your place of work. Figuring out who do you go to. Oftentimes, a supervisor may be unfortunately involved in the conduct that is violating the law, and so you're navigating an already difficult process, and then you're being kind of compelled to do so on your own. Most folks are not familiar with arbitration. It sounds like an incredibly formal process. And it would not be incorrect if the employer says this is going to cost you money, because that means that oftentimes workers are absorbing some of the cost for the process itself. And in addition to that, they can say you're going to be unlucky in this system because we've navigated this a couple of times and your fellow workers haven't done very well in the process. And as you point out, like, that is true. Yeah. So it's not as advantageous. People do worse in the system than they do in court.
Well, there are meant to be entities that are enforcing these workplace rules, you know, even if the sort of David versus Goliath situation of individual workers is disadvantageous. There are protective entities, government agencies that are meant to be looking out for them. The report also deals with problems in that enforcement area. What's the problem or the concern there?
This is sort of a perfect storm, in my view, because what you're seeing is decreased public enforcement. There are fewer and fewer public dollars being invested in enforcing workplace protections. So at the same time that many of us in our work are being asked to sign away our private right of action through this system of forced arbitration, we are also facing fewer and fewer cops on the beat in terms of public enforcement of those rights. The Department of Labor, State Departments of Labor, budgets have decreased while the workforce has expanded. And that leaves all of us with less protection in the workplace. And also combined with forced arbitration, it's such an incredible advantage, which is where that sort of ominous title of this report comes from. Yeah. You know, it is an incredible advantage to corporate employers at this point because they are making enforcement of any means, whether private or public, something that the vast majority of the workforce is losing access to.
Well, we have these laws, you know, we make these laws on wages, against wage theft or on workplace safety.
And then it seems like with EPIC, the Supreme Court is just kind of waving them away. I mean, it's kind of a balance of powers question too, isn't it? I mean, it seems like a real lopsided power that the court is exercising here.
Absolutely. And in my view, Congress needs to act on this to restore the rights that were hard-won protections when they were originally enacted. Title VII, the right that fundamentally you can't be discriminated against, harassed in the workplace, that's an enacted law. That's an enacted protection. And essentially, it has been made very difficult, if not impossible, for, you know, many, many workers in this country to access that right. Congress needs to then restore the right and sort of say, hey, you know, Supreme Court, you've misinterpreted this. You've essentially made this something that is no longer enforceable for the vast majority of workers when we gave this protection to the U.S. workforce. You've overstepped, just as you said, and now we want to correct you. And this is not the first time that something like this has happened where Congress have had to come in and, you know, correct something that the Supreme Court has misinterpreted, and is my hope that they will do so here, because this cuts across fundamental rights like even being paid the minimum wage. It is more difficult to enforce those rights when you have a system of forced arbitration that the Supreme Court has essentially blessed at this point in time.
Well, let me just ask you finally about specifically the legislative moves that are underway. How do the Restoring Justice for Workers Act and the Forced Arbitration Repeal Act address this outrage, and what's the status of those legislative pieces?
Both bills that you just referenced would prohibit forced arbitration and class and collective action waivers in any kind of employment dispute. So workers could no longer be compelled on their first day on the job to sign away those rights. And both bills are pending both in the House and Senate, so they've been introduced. And I really encourage listeners to contact their representatives and encourage them to insist on passage of those bills. The Fair Labor Standards Act, the National Labor Relations Act, our health and safety protections, they're only as meaningful as our ability to enforce them. And without the Restoring Justice for Workers Act or the Forced Arbitration Repeal Act, we are going to be increasingly unable to enforce those fundamental rights. So we really need Congress to act to restore them on our behalf.
We've been speaking with Celine McNicholas, Director of Government Affairs and Labor Council at the Economic Policy Institute. You can find the report Unchecked Corporate Power on EPI's website, epi.org. Celine McNicholas, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
We frequently hear calls for transparency from government entities, complaints about a lack of openness from agencies and departments, and barriers to access to documents intended by law to be public. And such calls and complaints are well warranted. But sunshine on the shrouded actions of the state isn't so much a quest for knowledge as a tool for change. In other words, we need to keep asking, transparency for what? A new project seems to be aimed right at that question. The Center for Constitutional Rights has just launched the Open Records Project, FOIA for the Movement. The project is coordinated by Ian Head, senior legal worker at CCR, co-editor of the Jailhouse Lawyer's Handbook, and a former executive vice president of the National Lawyers Guild. He joins us now by phone from here in town. Welcome to Counterspin, Ian Head.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, justice advocates of all stripes know we're kind of in the hellmouth right now. On many fronts, there's a lot of work to be done. What is the particular problem or need or deficit that this project is a response to? Why did you think we need to do this now?
This project really comes out of Center for Constitutional Rights hearing from our grassroots partners and community partners on the ground about their use of both FOIA, the kind of federal FOIA requests, and state open requests as a really important tool for their campaigns and movement priorities. And I think instead of having us at the center racing around and trying to answer requests when we can and helping out here and there, creating this new Open Records Project provides a place, a more centralized place that can work on resources that come out of what we've been hearing from folks on the ground and can be used by them, as well as potentially give trainings connect them with legal resources. We just put out a guide called FOIA Basics for Activists, and we're hoping that that's a helpful resource for just getting grounded and starting using FOIA requests and state open records requests for organizers and organizations. We're looking to hopefully provide online webinars, in-person trainings, additional electronic resources, and connect people to other FOIA experts who are out there. We are definitely not the only people litigating and doing FOIA requests. There's a significant amount of expertise out there, and I think we just want to kind of create a new point where that specifically is targeted as a resource for activists rather than just, say, journalists or just other groups that might be using FOIA.
Journalists, you probably think FOIA requests are about you, was the lead on a piece in Columbia Journalism Review a couple of years ago, and it actually reported that journalists are just a small fraction, 7.6% of requests under the Freedom of Information Act. And in fact, it's businesses, law firms, and individuals who are using FOIA more often, which I think might be surprising to people a little bit. But the truth is that the gatekeeper journalists are not, although there are examples of journalists using FOIA to tremendous effect, of course, but they are not the main folks using it. So it's important that other people know how to.
Absolutely.
Well, where would you like to reporters, though, to see themselves in this project?
The reporters play such a key role in often assisting our movement partners to achieve their goals, reporting on the findings of these requests and helping shape the narrative that is so important for our grassroots partners and their campaigns to push forward and reach, whether it's reach other people in their community or reach the places in power, Congress and others. I think it's critical that journalists are part of this.
Yeah, I always say with regard to whistleblowers, you know, whistleblowers can pitch, but reporters have to catch. And it's the same for data. You know, if it's allowed to be accessed, but nobody bumps it with a trumpet, you know, or puts it to use, then it just, the power of the knowledge is kind of squandered. In the case of the whistleblower, that could be their whole life that went into getting this information out, and we can't just let it lay on the page. And that's what I see in this project of really trying to not just get the information, but use the information to make a difference in the world.
Exactly.
Talking to media using it, USA Today, for example, has compiled this incredible national database on police officers that have been banned from the profession. It's information that was kept secret by lots of folks, and they used state open record laws to collect these public records about police conduct. And they actually have been detailing just how difficult it is. They said in state after state, USA Today had to employ the assistance of its lawyers to gain access to the public records, a resource that citizens walking in the door searching for public information often don't have. So the state level, even though the project names FOIA, the state level is really critical here too, right?
Absolutely. The state level is, especially right now, really critical. And we've definitely had certain successes in getting records and getting records faster at times at the state level rather than through the FOIA.
Are there any cases that for you at CCR make especially clear the importance of these access laws about things like FOIA?
I mentioned that we're doing these FOIAs on behalf of or just supporting FOIA requests from our grassroots partners.
Right.
So one of our partners recently was Color of Change, which is a great organization, does a lot of advocacy around racial justice issues. They have been hearing from their people about the surveillance of black activists, especially around a lot of the protests against police brutality in the last several years. We did together a FOIA request to DHS and FBI to get more information about this surveillance. COC chose to connect with journalists and try to build some press just around the request and the litigation itself so that there was a story being told about why they were asking for this information, the importance of getting at this information from the government. So even before we started getting documents, I think it was really amazing to see how COC strategized around using the request in that way. And then among the documents we got were a number of scary reports and emails, but one of them was a series of emails that referred to something called, literally, the DHS analysts were calling it the race paper. That's how it was referred to in the emails. And we actually had the so-called race paper produced to us as well, but completely redacted. There was nothing visible except for just a big black square on 8 pages of paper. And again, we litigated to try to get at least part of that unredacted. Ultimately, a judge looked at that and said that it was a draft paper, and so it couldn't be released. But the organizing around the litigation by COC and others got a lot of media attention, going back to what you were saying and we were saying about the importance of journalists. And so there was a lot of bubbling of, what is this race paper? Why are they hiding it? What is this? Does it connect to the leaked FBI report on so-called black identity extremists? And that has continued. And actually, Representative Donald Payne, I believe, okay, of New Jersey, mm-hmm, in a recent hearing with DHS officials, questioned them about what the race paper is. In fact, holding up the 8 redacted pages in the hearing to say, why can't you tell me what this is? Why is there something that's been produced called the race paper?
That's a great illustration of how sometimes even when you don't get the information, you get the story, you know, mm-hmm, because the digging reveals something that is in itself informative.
Absolutely.
We've been speaking with Ian Head, senior legal worker at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and you can find out more about the Open Records Project, FOIA for the Movement, at their website, ccrjustice.org. Thank you very much, Ian Head, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.